Welcome to Emotional Sobriety.
Here with Alan and Tom, we've got another Grapevine article queued up for you both. But before we get into that, let's just do a brief check-in. How is everybody today, and how is our emotional sobriety?
I left my emotional sobriety in my other pants. I need to go get it. Where's my car keys? But I know right where it is, and I'm going to get it right after we finish. It's a beautiful day here in Nashville, Tennessee, and wind's blowing and the sun's out, and I'm going to go figure out, I'm maybe going to plant some flowers or something today. That'll help my emotional sobriety.
Typically does, getting grounded, literally, you know, smelling the roses.
No,
right?
That's one of the things. I had clients for years who would talk about hands in the dirt and get in that stuff that they needed. It was the therapeutic value of it. And I never thought about it at all. It's like, right. But I had a friend, my friend Bendel died a few years ago, and he was a rosebush guy. I mean, he was a botanist anyway, but he was a rosebush guy. He would practice Robert Fulghum used to call positive vandalism. He would sneak into your yard and plant a rose bush, you know. So I mean, you just find it in your yard someplace. It's like anyway. After he died, I decided I was going to plant some stuff in his honor. So I got some roses and did this, and just got into that and really realized that it really is cool to get literally, like you said, literally grounded.
A great story, Tom.
He was a wonderful man.
I'm at the final day of this three-day intensive, trauma intensive workshop that I've done, and we've got 10 participants. And you know, like what you said, Tom, when a workshop starts, you tell the people that right now everybody's a stranger, but by the time the weekend ends, they're going to be closer to these people than you are to a lot of the family that you know.
Oh man! By the end of the first section of it, you're already, you know, connected.
It's amazing, man. It's really a great experience, and people are getting so much out of it. And so I'm really excited, man. I've been in my groove, and first day I was operating only on a 1 hour sleep. That wasn't good. But the last sleep 6 hours, and talk about, you know, one component of my emotional sobriety is my rest, my sleep.
You bet.
I'm not getting good sleep, man. I'm just not my best self.
No, and I think in general, I mean, that's just a good thing for us to generalize. And just, if anybody is listening who has any doubt about that, I mean, I've watched that, I've known that myself. I've watched that in clients through the years. Sleep deprivation is not something to be just tossed off. I mean, if you're not getting enough sleep, that will make everything worse. It just does.
Everything worse.
Yeah.
Well, I'm excited. We're continuing our work. Oh, Patrick, we need to check in on your emotional sobriety. How are you?
He's got a cold.
I know. I heard it. And he's muted.
We can't hear you, Patrick. He's also muted.
Well, I do have a cold. We won't focus on that today. But I thought what might be applicable to emotional sobriety for this morning is I was having a nice conversation with my girlfriend yesterday about future tripping. Because from personal experience, you know, I've been through passages of my life where I spend a lot of time in the future, you know, trying to plan for trouble down the pass, making elaborate plans, packing an escape raft, you know, from whatever malady I'm going through in the present, and just living in the future. I've also spent a lot of time in my cups, lamenting the mistakes that I made in the past. And I think that John Lennon quote, life is what happens to you while you're making other plans. Like mm-hmm. When I heard that, I kind of, something opened up. And I think a lot of what we talk about in emotional sobriety has to do with just being as alive and awake as possible to the possibilities in the present moment. And I say that to somebody, or I urge somebody towards, you know, that pathway, being somebody who's rarely been there, being somebody who still struggles a lot with being present, but knowing that that's the white whale that I keep chasing. And, you know, it truly, for somebody like me, with such an addictive personality and, you know, my mental health struggles and whatnot, it's very hard sometimes to stay present, to stay with everything that's happening. But to me, that's the crux of like what, you know, could be my salvation, right? Is if I'm not trying to so desperately to get away from what's happening right now, but I'm really awake to those things that are happening and taking advantage, right?
And you're not alone with that, Patrick. I mean, you say somebody like you could easily say this. I know in this company, with the three of us, you could easily say somebody like us, because we're right there with you.
We are on a moving sidewalk today, so we have a story to get to. But I guess I'll just throw out here telling the difference between future tripping and planning with a real utility and function and helpfulness mm-hmm. that we need to be doing in order to keep ourselves on the straight and narrow. Like mm-hmm. that can be difficult sometimes.
You land on it. Planning for the future and learning from the past are present tense experiences. Any other time in the future or the past is probably not good use of your time. And you're right. It's not just an easy thing, but that's, I think you're giving it is that you, those words help. Am I planning? Am I making a plan? Or am I reviewing something I've learned? And if not, then you're just ruminating one way or the other.
We're always reminded of make your plans, but don't plan the results.
That's it, man. That's one of those cliches. Not the chairman of the results committee. One of those cliches in AA that I just love.
All the results loosely in your hands. Do not grip them tight. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a setup. See, that's an expectation.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks so much, Alan. All right. Well, let's move ahead to Once a Zombie.
I love it. I love the name. Once a Zombie. I already identify with this with the article. I haven't even seen it yet. Once a Zombie. I got one.
Once a Zombie. A grandmother who floated into AA in the 60s, a frightful sight, recalls how lucky she was that she stayed. 1968 uh-huh. was a year of cultural upheaval, political assassinations, men landing on the moon, and war on the other side of the world. For me, it was the year I found AA. I had a TV, but it didn't work, so I had no clue about what was going on in the world. And I really didn't care. I just wanted that next drink. I was told to go to Al-Anon. The people there told me to go to AA. I did what I was told just because I didn't want to make waves. I thank God for that.
At my first AA meeting, the people there asked me my name. My father had told me that AA was a cult, so I was very cautious and wouldn't tell anyone my first or last name. I wanted to be very anonymous, so they gave me a nickname. At first, some called me Zombie because I was still drinking. I floated through the meeting doors feeling like I was 2 feet off the ground. I often wore a long black dress and was 25 pounds underweight. My long, stringy hair gave me a look of Morticia from the Addams Family. I would stand with my back against the wall next to the door.
Not willing.
Willing to even get coffee because I did not want to sit down next to those people, even though everyone looked a lot better than I did.
After I got sober, my nickname was changed to Clueless. Wow. And well, for some, that's what I was. I had brought the body to AA for several months and the mind did follow eventually. Fortunately, I listened. And in December of 1968, the compulsion to drink lifted and I've been sober ever since. I finally rejoined the human race. In AA, I learned how to be sober in a life full of both miracles and tragedies amid the grind of daily living. Here are just two early miracles. In my 30s, I gave birth to two children after having been told at 19 years old that I would never have a baby. Two deaths were particularly bad. First was my husband and soulmate. We had met in AA. When we moved to another state, he started drinking again and stopped going to meetings. Mm. He died of alcoholism. Wow. Just three years after picking up again, leaving me alone with our two small children. The second death occurred when my 16-year-old grandson was killed in an accident.
Mm.
No drugs or alcohol involved. For a long time after these deaths, I hated the phrase, life on life's terms.
In sobriety, I became a wife, a mother, an employee, and a functioning member of society. I've learned to live a day at a time. I'm quite a far cry from that zombie or the clueless one I was when I first came into the rooms. Before AA, I was an agnostic, having never attended any church. I still don't attend any religious services, but I have a time of prayer and meditation every day. This has given me a relationship with my higher power, whose presence I feel is with me every moment of every day, giving me strength to deal with, yes, life on life's terms. Sobriety, it's been quite a trip. I've worked diligently to preserve this amazing gift with meetings, prayer, and service. Is it worth it? Yes. But we never have it made, do we? As the big book says, what we really have is a daily reprieve.
I love this one, man. I know I say that every damn time, but I love it.
Yeah, there's so many things that jump out, aren't there?
Mm-hmm.
God bless her, and God bless the group of people who allowed her to keep coming, even though she was still drinking.
Yeah, not judging, right? Yeah.
Because we have a desire to not drink, it doesn't mean that we're not drinking.
Yeah.
Right? Only requirement for membership is a desire to not drink. It doesn't say that we successfully achieved that. So the fact that the group had that much flexibility is a real comment on a healthy part of that group, right? It was obviously what she needed. And, you know, too, that she just accepted the title of zombie at first and then clueless later on. And obviously that changed. You know, it wasn't a tag or a label that...
at least in hindsight, you know, she wore those nicknames with honor, and it's like, you know, and I think that's the way to do it. It's like, and to realize that from zombie to clueless is a damn promotion. It's
that's
like,
right.
Congratulations.
Right. It is. And then the other thing that really stands out, and I really love this because this is a drum that we beat so often.
She talks about that AA life is filled with miracles and tragedies, right? There's always two sides. We can accept the miracles. We can accept the success, sometimes not completely if we don't feel worthy of it, but it's a lot easier to wrap our heads around life when life goes our way and when it does what we expect it to do. The real challenge of any program and anybody's emotional sobriety is what to do when life doesn't, right, conform to your expectations, to your wishes, to your hopes, to your dreams, to your desires. And that's the place so many of us end up, you know, experiencing in recovery. And if we don't have an ongoing practice of emotional sobriety, we can become quite disillusioned, right? At that moment, that when things aren't turning out, and we can even get
but what you just said is, it's sort of like when they say in the wedding vows, you know, for better or worse. And you and I've talked about how we'll tell couples don't fall for that. It's not better or worse. It's better and worse. It's all coming. And it's like, so the first step in emotional sobriety there is to really work on you don't need to be surprised when the tragedies happen. You have a lot of work to do. You can hurt, you can do all that stuff, but we got to stop being surprised when life happens. For every loss, we gain something, and for everything we gain, we lose something, you know, and just the cyclical nature of life that way, you know, everything that's an ending is a beginning. And every beginning is letting go of something in the past. I often say that people who are parents know that. Alan, you know that. It's like for every developmental age your child goes through, you're saying goodbye to, you know, I'm saying goodbye to the toddler, you know, and hello to another part of this. And it's like, it's grief and it's celebration.
Yep, that's right. Well, and it does too, you know, go back to what we talk about all the time, that emotional sobriety is a shift, right? Is a consciousness of freedom, mm-hmm. of emotional freedom. And what we're talking about here is that when I've got the mentality or the consciousness that says I'm okay if, I'm in trouble, right? There's
right,
a problem
right.
there. When my consciousness shifts to I'm okay even if, then we can accept those tragedies and deal with them
And once again, garner whatever wisdom we can garner from the pain or the grief, the loss that we're going through, and then use that wisdom to get on with our life. My happiness, my well-being is no longer determined by what's happening to me. It's determined by how I deal with it.
How I respond. Yeah.
We go, you talk about it as being going from being a victim of life to being able to be a hero. I mean, that's what we talk about, the hero's journey. The hero's journey of sobriety. And so what we do is we take these experiences and we garner from them whatever wisdom we can from the suffering, from the pain, from the loss. And we use that wisdom to now move to what's next in our life, a little bit better off from what we've gone through. A little bit better prepared to deal with whatever life is going to throw, whatever task life is going to set before us and next. I mean, and that's what this emotional sobriety is, a constant evolution of moving us towards what we can be. And what we can be is, as a fully functioning human being, is quite adaptive. We're quite an amazing species. There's no question about it.
We set ourselves up to fail by thinking sometimes that acceptance means that we're okay with it. We like it. It's, you know, we're not resisting it. You know, Patrick was talking about it when, even at the check-in and stuff like that, in terms of his struggle with being in the present and drifting to the past and future. It's like, no, what part of what we accept is our own imperfection, our own, to use the word from the article, our own cluelessness that goes with it. It's like, it's okay. It's, you know, Rodney Crowell has a song that I love that's called Life is Messy. It's, and I like the song, but I love the title. And I think it's a good one for us to remember. And life is messy, and it's always going to be messy.
And I also like life is lifey.
Life is lifey.
Yeah, life getting lifey. I think a lot about, I've been thinking a lot about my sponsee. There's been a genuine transformation, I think, that's taken place in the first year of his recovery. And he got some bad news recently, or he's been struggling with some stuff. Like the job that he's been faithfully going to 5 days a week, you know, they found out he had a criminal record and let him go. Beyond that, you know, he's begun the process of, you know, he's well into the process of clearing the wreckage of his past. You know, he wants to be able to have a relationship with his son, and he wants to be able to go with his son to like a doctor's appointment and stuff, and just to kind of be a presence in his kid's life. But very understandably, that, you know, that's a long road, and you know, I don't think his son's ready to welcome him back yet. And I just, like, when I see him and what he's going through, and every day that he ticks of sobriety through this through this desert of like not seeing any returns for like the work that he's doing, or those returns being slow to come, like I almost think of it like We need to, like, think of our own recoveries as like a movie that somebody else is watching. And then this is the part of the movie when there's the pain and the struggle before catharsis. And we're not feeling, you know, kind of like, you know, the beauty and the meaning of that struggle, because we're the ones enduring it. And often in sobriety recovery, which is a lifelong process, there's nothing that feels too good about it. But, you know, when those people, when we check in at the, in the meetings and talk about this kind of thing, other people see it, and there's a transfer of energy, and like, you know, we can give that strength to others as we kind of like soldier through day after day, through the badness, right? And committing to recovery, and that can like, that can really lift people up, you know. Even if ourselves are not lifted up, we can lift other people up. And and so I'm just really proud of him. I think he's doing the right thing. I try to like just communicate this as much as possible to him, even if he can't feel it. There's times when he can't feel it, and he just feels bad, and he's filled with shame, and you know, just regret, you know, for all the mistakes he made when he was out there. like Alan always says, you know, feeling bad isn't necessarily a sign that your recovery is going poorly. It just means that.
No, sometimes it's the opposite. I had a group that had the slogan, feeling bad, doing good. You know, the reason you're feeling bad is because you're not medicating in the ways you used to do. And it's like and Alan, you know this from, I mean, the old days. It's like, it just reminds me of one of those basic things that we're telling people coming into the program. And it's just true for emotional sobriety as just substance abuse is, I promise you, you're going to have to work on this whole idea of delayed gratification. Because if to the degree that we get impatient, you know, we're gonna lose our place if we're not careful. Hang on, the good is coming.
I found that to be true. My sister calls me now, and we've got a relationship. That was a family member that I had that was the longest to kind of come around to.
Right for you.
And it's crazy. I mean, it actually did happen. I got to a point, right about the time that I got to the point where I was making peace with the fact that it might never happen, that's when it started happening.
Ain't that the way?
Easy way. So look at next week. Let's talk about what's happening, right? Next week, we're going to be in London, Patrick.
Let's record while we're eating one of those enormous British breakfasts with the beans and like 20 sausages.
I was telling Patrick that I have a client, one of my clients who live in London. I had a session yesterday, and I had never, and I'm always amazed at the vocabulary differences, is I never heard the word gym used as a verb, but she talks about gymming.
Yeah, I've been doing gymming here in the States, and I caught a virus the first week that I went back. So I should really try out some of those British viruses. You know, I need to go over there and see if I can get sick the British way, virusing while I'm gymming. Yeah.
You guys have fun. And be sure and miss me.
We will miss you.
Have much, much, much fun.
All right. Until next time.
Tend your life. Tend your myth. Cultivate your narrative with whomever you're with.